When I was 12, I learned that monsters don't hide under beds. They tuck you into them. My father, Richard Davis, the respected pharmacist of Brobridge, Louisiana, was arrested for murdering 6 teenage girls during one sweltering summer. I was the one who found the evidence, a collection of trinkets hidden in his shed, hair ribbons, friendship bracelets, small mementos stolen from each victim. That discovery shattered my childhood and set me on a path I never chose. 20 years later, I've rebuilt my life in Baton Rouge as a psychologist specializing in trauma. I have a successful practice, a modernist home, and a fiancé from old money. I've created distance, 90 carefully measured miles, from my hometown and its memories. But when teenage girls start disappearing again, with frightening similarities to my father's crimes, the carefully constructed walls of my new life begin to crumble. The past isn't just haunting me, it's hunting me.
The first disappearance could be coincidence. 15-year-old Aubrey Gravino vanishes while walking home from band practice. But when my patient Lacey Deckler also disappears, the similarities become impossible to ignore. Both teenage girls vanished without struggle while walking from after-school activities, just like 20 years ago. The timing feels deliberately cruel, just weeks before my father's arrest anniversary. My professional training becomes both shield and curse. I analyze patterns clinically, yet my hypervigilance transforms every shadow into a threat. I write unauthorized Xanax prescriptions under my fiancé's name, washing pills down with wine just to function. My relationship with my brother Cooper remains fractured by our shared trauma. Our mother lives in a care facility after her suicide attempt, and my father sends letters from Angola prison I can't open. At Aubrey's crime scene in Cypress Cemetery, my blood runs cold. These aren't metaphors. They're how trauma lives in my body, always ready to erupt when triggered by familiar patterns.
We all wear masks, but some conceal monsters. I present myself as a healed professional while dependent on medication. My fiancé Daniel projects support while hiding his knowledge of my past. Even Aaron Jansen, the journalist covering my father's crimes, conceals deeper motives. I constantly search for my father's darkness in myself, viewing aggressive thoughts as potential inherited evil. This genetic determinism affects my career choice and hesitation about having children. Finding Aubrey's necklace triggered immediate suspicion of Daniel, reflecting my belief that intimacy might be dangerous. My sense of self fractured at 12 when my father was arrested, forcing me to reconstruct my identity. I navigate life seeing myself as victim, survivor, and potential perpetrator simultaneously. I'm a cliché, the killer's daughter who became a psychologist, while recognizing this self-awareness doesn't free me from the pattern. I understand how killers construct alternative identities to move through society. My father perfected this duality, loving parent while hunting teenage girls. This profound deception represents the ultimate betrayal and haunts my ability to trust my perceptions. The Louisiana I know isn't from travel brochures. It's the oppressive humidity that stifles breath, isolated bayous where secrets remain buried, and small towns where everyone knows your business but not your truth. Brobridge, the crawfish capital, holds both innocent childhood memories of spotting alligators and unspeakable horror. The town's size magnified the murder's impact. Everyone knew the victims, everyone became suspect, and my family became pariahs. I tried escaping to Baton Rouge, creating a garden district home with a conventional mailbox, attempts at normalcy. But geography can't save you from what haunts your mind. When evidence links Daniel to the murders, even my sanctuary feels contaminated. My childhood home stands abandoned yet preserved like a time capsule, mirroring how trauma arrests development, keeping parts of ourselves locked in catastrophe's moment. Angola Prison, where my father serves life, looms over my consciousness despite my avoidance. Its presence on highway signs triggers anxiety, reminding me some connections can never be severed.
How do you escape a legacy written in blood? My life has been defined by my father's crimes through public stigma and psychological inheritance. Cooper and I share this burden, but are pulled apart by our different coping mechanisms. My mother's suicide attempt left us managing both my father's crimes and her abandonment. Cooper withdrew, while I became hypervigilant. Neither approach fully healed us, suggesting recovery requires confrontation rather than avoidance. Burt Rhodes, father of victim Lena, embodies another trauma response, vengeful rage. His grief manifests as alcoholism, abuse, and obsession with punishing those connected to his daughter's death, showing how unprocessed trauma consumes lives. The community worsened her suffering. Bro Bridge turned against our entire family, treating us as accomplices rather than fellow victims. This reflects society's discomfort with trauma's gray areas, the recognition that victims and perpetrators sometimes share family trees. I constantly question whether I can truly separate myself from my family's legacy. Can we trust minds shaped by trauma? My perceptions alternate between hypervigilant observation and significant blind spots, especially regarding those closest to me. Childhood memories shift throughout my investigation, with details emerging as present events trigger past associations. My recollections of Lena Rhodes evolve as specific interactions resurface, trauma memories returning, not as coherent narratives, but as fragmented sensory impressions gradually coalescing. Self-medication undermines my reliability. Xanax, Ativan, and alcohol create awareness gaps, like losing an entire day after taking Aaron's pills. These substances blur the line between genuine insight and paranoid projection, making me question whether my suspicions about Daniel represent legitimate danger or drug-induced paranoia. I've built my understanding of my father's crimes around facts that, when challenged, threaten my entire worldview, similar to how trauma survivors create explanatory frameworks for psychological structure, even when inaccurate. My unreliability doesn't invalidate my experience, but demonstrates how trauma distorts perception while sharpening certain instincts. The most devastating truth was discovering my brother Cooper was the actual killer who manipulated our father into taking blame, the ultimate betrayal. Yet this revelation freed me from decades of uncertainty. Confronting the complete truth allowed authentic healing to begin. Recovery from trauma demands both truth and action. I didn't just learn about Cooper's guilt. I gathered evidence, recorded his confession, and ensured justice for his victims. This agency was crucial in reclaiming my life. I returned Daniel's engagement ring to his sister Sophie, recognizing our relationship was partly built on mutual trauma, showing my growing ability to distinguish between authentic connection and trauma bonding. In the end, I catch and release a firefly, symbolizing my evolving relationship with my past. This brief capture demonstrates my ability to acknowledge history without being imprisoned by it. Recovery is an ongoing process of integration, learning to carry painful truths while refusing to be defined by them. Sometimes the brightest light comes after the darkest shadow, and healing begins when we finally face our monsters.